there a writing craft book on your bedside table? Has it been there for a while?
Do you keep meaning to get past chapter 2, or chapter 1, or just the first page?
Then the Words to Write By podcast is for you. Hi, I'm Renee. I teach composition and creative writing to college students. My background is in poetry, but I'm working on my memoir.
And I'm Kim. I'm trained as a science journalist, but now I'm trying my hand at short fiction. Each week, we'll be tackling a chapter of some well-known, but perhaps not so well-read, writing craft book.
Together, we'll uncover brilliant insights, face the hard truths, and totally disagree when the author is wrong.
This is our podcast, after all.
And then, we're going to take what we learn and apply it to our own writing.
By doing the book's suggested exercises.
We're inviting you to read along, or just tune in for the Cliff Notes version.
We're committed to improving our own craft, one writing advice book at a time, and we'd love for you to join us. Hello, listeners. Do we sound better right now? What do you think, Renee?
I think we do.
What could be causing that better sound?
I don't know. It's a mysterious thing. It's like the sound gods have smiled upon us.
Our microphones have been kind of dying on us. Renee's died out completely, and so we decided we needed new microphones, and since we've been serious about this for a while, we took the next step in recording studio equipment.
Yes, we did.
So we got the microphones, we've got the pop guard, we've got one of them attached to a fancy arm. And so we were thinking maybe as a way to offset the cost of this, we would put up a tip jar.
Yeah, so just real quick, think of your favorite tip jar, and I'll tell you mine. My favorite tip jar is this tip jar at a cookie place in Santa Cruz. And what they've done with the tip jar is they filled it with water. So there's like floaty dollar bills in there and stuff because there's a lot of homeless people trying to steal money. So they put it in a like fishbowl with water. Think of our tip jar as that cool fishbowl with water. You know you want to put a dollar in it just to see what happens when it gets all soggy. You want to plunk a little coin in there and hear that little clunk sound. I'm just saying we're two ladies in a closet that are now in the hole a little bit. And it would be really great is if we came out even with this podcast. Because if you've thought about making a podcast and how much money it would go on, it doesn't actually have to cost a lot of money.
I mean, the real thing of a podcast is the time that it takes to put into it. But then there's the money expense afterwards. And we are willing to give our time for free. But if we could get a little bit back for the expense of the equipment, that would be awesome.
You got it. We sound way better, right?
So where's the tip jar going
to
be?
The tip jar is on the website. You just go to the website. It's at the top right. It says tip jar. You click on it and you can leave us a tip. If you like what we're doing, if you feel like you've gained a lot of perspective or, you know, a really good strategy from us.
I mean, this way you don't have to buy the books. So there's money right there.
We have saved you 4 books worth of money, dear listener. Just saying.
And with that, let's move on to the podcast itself. Last week, we were discussing the concept of the shitty first draft. And so I reached out to some authors that use this technique. So let's hear what they have to say about it.
Hi, my name is Delta James. I'm a USA Today bestselling author, mostly paranormal romance and then steamy romantic suspense, sometimes a combination thereof. My most popular series is one called Mystic River Shifters. And the third book in that series, Reckless Mate, just came out this past weekend.
So you have over 100 books published?
Not quite 100. My 100th book will be published May the 19th.
You must write fast then.
I do. I write very fast and I'm very prolific and have a lot of fun doing what I do.
But you also said that you edit as you go along. So you don't write a single first draft, but you are changing as you go along. How does that work?
I'm always editing. My alpha reader is also my best friend, and we share a house together. And at the end of every day, I send Chris whatever I've written the day before. And so she goes through it looking for continuity, missing words, all the things that are coming in a rough draft. Also, at the beginning of each day, I go back and at least read the last chapter I wrote so that I can get back into the book. And I'm very lucky because I do work at home and I do work full time. I can write uninterrupted for 10 or 12 hours at a stretch. And by not having to stop and go fix dinner for everybody or stop and go to a job or stop and do this, stop and do that, I have that nice continual flow. And I think that really helps in a first draft.
But do you ever get stuck, like not knowing what comes next?
Sometimes, absolutely. I will sometimes talk to Chris because she's read the books up to then, so she knows where I am. Sometimes we'll go for a drive, take the dogs down to the beach and go for a walk and, clear our heads. If I'm really, really having trouble, I'll go 2 to 3 chapters back up into the story and read again and try and get myself back into the flow.
I don't think that you have a problem with your inner editor like shutting things down and causing you to rewrite and rewrite and rewrite chapters.
Once in a blue moon, I'll write something and I'll go, well, that's not any good. And I'll scrap 5,000 words. Now, I don't scrap it. I cut it out of that manuscript and I save it over in a file I have of cut scenes, cut dialogue, cut this, cut that. And so sometimes if I'm going along and I get kind of stuck, I'll go look at that file. Ooh, that would work in there. And I pick that up and I plop it back in. Now, I think sometimes if we allow ourselves to get out of the habit of writing. I got really, really sick at the beginning of the year, had some nasty respiratory thing. And I really literally couldn't write for like 2 or 3 days. Getting back into writing with just that short a break was so difficult. And it's the reason why, even if I don't feel good or if I have other things to do, I write every single day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. Yes, I write on Thanksgiving. Yes, I write on Christmas. Maybe not as much as normal, but I write. It's something I have to do.
Well, it's got impressive results. I can say that much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
So my name is Richard Reisenberg. I write primarily literary stories and noir stories. And you can find my first published noir novel, The Dust Will Answer, on Amazon or many other better websites than theirs.
You say that you write slow first drafts that are pretty close to the final version. How slow is slow?
How slow is slow? When I first started to get serious about writing and marketing the fiction, I decided to spend a year just writing random notes for a memoir. And I gave myself a quota of at least 300 words per day. And of course, I'm allowed to exceed the quota, but I'm not allowed to come out underneath. So I have to meet the quota, and I have to meet it before I can have breakfast, which adds to the incentive. At that pace, I do write fairly slowly. I think I calculated it earlier this morning at about 10 words per minute on average. And in a year, I'd written a 98,000 word memoir. That was all written kind of shitty first draft style. But when I got down to writing stories, I did another disciplinary action because I tend to overwrite. I decided to spend a year writing only flash fiction. 1,000 words, not 999, not 1,002. And I did that and started getting published all over the place. Flash fiction is easier to place, of course, but I did it as a disciplinary measure. Again, still writing at the 300 words minimum per morning quota, 5 to 6 mornings a week. I said, I'll treat it like a job, although not a job that takes all day. Then I started expanding into more traditional story lengths. I'd actually started writing the novels before the stories. And I did that the same way, 300 words per day minimum, but written slowly so I wouldn't have to do too much editing and revision.
The reason why people recommend writing a very quick first draft is because often writers will be writing along and the first 20,000 words are great and they'll hit a point where they're not either not sure what comes next or they're not liking how it looks or they'll get stuck. The result is they never finish. So have you in your process ever gotten to a point where you are stuck? And then how do you continue onward with this like slow, steady approach?
It doesn't happen to me very often because I work from the personalities of the characters in the story. Personalities of the characters are something I either build carefully or have come up from the subconscious, and I don't know where they came from, but they're there. So once these personalities begin interacting, they kind of write the story for me. Somebody says something and that leads to something else. A case in point is in that first novel, I got to a point where I wanted little bit of comic relief. So I had the characters encounter these other two characters, one of whom was this kind of brassy, loudmouthed woman, not a beauty, short, a little zaftig, strong features. I made her like a Sicilian. And she ran away with the story. She became a real character. And the people who reviewed the story actually thought she was the best thing in the book. They were actually mad at me in the third manuscript where I killed her off.
So what you're saying is that when you're writing and you get stuck, you are able to just let the characters just go along and you just kind of follow them. So even though you're writing slowly, your internal editor doesn't kick on and stop the story. You just kind of figure out another way around it.
Right. Now, in short stories, it's a little different. I have actually been experimenting with short stories that had no characters. In that case, if I do get stuck, I follow Hemingway's advice for the same situation, which was just write a simple declarative sentence. And it could be something banal, like, you know, one of the avocados was missing from the bowl. Or it could be something else like, my God, a rat just ran across the kitchen table. But just a simple sentence that comes from observation, even if it's observation of something that's not actually happening. And then that grounds you again in the ambience of the story, you know, where it's happening. Nothing happens in a vacuum. Things happen where we are, and where we are affects how things happen. So coming back to that will do it. Now, first drafts versus revision. One thing I almost always do on the second draft is shorten the beginning. I tend to write an overlong beginning. I recognize that. And so I cut it way back. Almost every story, no matter how slowly or carefully I've written it, has a little too much at the front end.
Well, I am MJ Bruneband, and the book I would like to highlight is Transistor Radio, which was just published. It follows Vance Imbrato, who is a lead singer and lead guitarist for the most popular band in 1982.
So let's talk about your draft process. Do you write it all out in one go?
I have published 6 novels, and basically for all 6, I have an idea. Like, I know where I'm going to start. I know how I want to finish it. And I pretty much have no idea what happens through 98% of the novel. I just start writing and things begin to pop in my head.
And so you go from beginning to end with pretty much a one pass through?
Yeah, once I've done the first pass, then usually I'll let it sit for a week or two. My day-to-day job is as a state inspector, so I'll be driving in the car, and all the while I'm going through scenes in my head and different dialogue. So then when I go back a second time, that's when I really try to add a little bit more detail, some more punch, some more depth to the characters. And then on my third pass is where I'll correct the fact that I've used the same word twice in one paragraph. I really do the fine tuning.
Would you want to show people that first draft when you get it done?
I think with one novel that I did, yes, because it just flowed out of me. And that was Transistor Radio, because I've had 5 other novels to cut my teeth on.
What made it so that you had a much more solid draft when you got done writing it as opposed to the earlier ones?
I think it was because before I started writing, I had gone through it in my head so many times that in my head, I had pretty much gone through the first and second drafts. Because I don't know how other writers are, but my imagination seems to enjoy tormenting me. I'll have one novel that I'm currently writing. I'll have a second one in my head that's 2/3 completed. Then I'll think of 2 other ones. So it's hard for me to stay focused on the one. You know, I think that's why, you know, Transistor Radio was easier to write, is because when I was writing my last novel, Bright Future, it took so much time that I was able to really firm up most of the story in my head and get it to the point of where it was a very good first draft.
So in that case, it wasn't like you had to discover 98% of the book while you were writing it. You actually knew like 66%.
Correct. And the funny thing is now, normally I abhor sequels, with the exception of, you know, The Godfather. But while I'm driving, I thought of the one salient point that my editor had on the novel, which was the father of the main character becomes an alcoholic and he basically fades away. And my editor said, look, what happens to the father? Of course, my imagination grabbed onto that and said, hey, wait a minute, we could do a really good follow-up, have the father come back. He's cleaned himself up. Now he wants to be a part of his life. And now, for the first time in my life, I've written down a complete skeleton, because I had so many ideas for so many character arcs and plot points that it was like a massive soup. And I had to go, okay, wait a minute. I got to sort this out.
It sounds like your writing process is evolving with each new book that you do.
Exactly. And because, you know, Transistor Radio, and it sounds arrogant of me, but because it's such a great story, I need any follow-up to be perfect and to not pander to the first one. It's the same characters 9 years later. And there's so much drama woven in between that time. And being reunited with his father is not going to be easy. And there will be other aspects that will make this so much more detailed.
Thank you so much. This was great. Really appreciate you taking the time.
Sure.
A big thanks to Delta, Rick, and Matt for a look into their writing process. You can find links to their books in our show notes on the Words to Write By website. So you've committed to Anne Lamott's daily writing practice. How do you turn those word scribbles into profound, meaningful insights? In this episode, we cover our chapters School Lunches and Polaroids, which, trust us, are about the transformative process. And it's on to the chapter called Character, where we talk about giving people in your book their own emotional acre. Okay, school lunches.
School lunches.
What is school lunches doing in a writing advice book?
Yeah, right? So, school lunches, this chapter. What she does here is she illustrates what that short assignment might look like, which was a few chapters ago. A few chapters, there's a chapter called Short Assignments. This is kind of what it looks like.
Or also like the idea of writing every day and just writing a bunch of stuff and coming back. What I like about this is that often people say, well, do this technique, but then they don't kind of show you how they take that technique and use it. And this is showing how she finds the gems in all that writing she does.
Yes. What she's also doing is she gives people a prompt on like to write about a school lunch. But what it really does is it's getting people to write specifically and to mine your memory from specific details. Because one of the biggest advice you'll get is to show, not tell. It's very nebulous. It doesn't make a lot of sense. And instead of saying that, she just illustrates it with this chapter. What she says is, I think this will show how taking short assignments and then producing really shitty first drafts of these assignments can yield a bounty of detailed memory, raw material, and strange characters lurking in the shadows. So the act of writing is the act of discovery. You figure things out through the writing. You discover things through the writing, right? But you do so from a detailed, specific lens. And for her, she just picked something rando, like a school lunch.
And she has several writings on a school lunch. And first of all, they're lovely writings. They're just personable and like the line of, here is the main thing I know about public school lunches. It only looked like a bunch of kids eating lunch. It was really about opening our insides in front of everyone. And so we're moving right from peanut butter sandwich and whether or not you bought your milk at school or not to like in-depth character detail mining of childhood and various experiences.
Yeah, you're just playing around trying to figure out what's in there. Or you're not even trying to figure out what's in there. You're just saying what's in there and what is usable will come at you later. You can't think your way out of this book. You right. have to write it out and then mine for stuff.
And I don't think you should pick an item like, you know, your first day of school and already know what the metaphor you're going to have is. You're not coming and saying, oh, I'm going to find this deep insight in this one activity I did. That's going to cause you to clench up and not write. Instead, you just start with the activity, you start with the memory, and you just push.
For example, she typed up her free writes and put them in the book, which I totally appreciate. She gave examples. And then after about three sections of free writing, she mentions a boy, which had nothing really to do with school lunches, but all of the talking about school lunches led her to this character.
She writes, "The boy against the fence appeared out of nowhere. I had no idea when I started writing that he was in my memory. To me, he is the most important thing that came out of this exercise. Tomorrow, when I sit down to work on my novel, he will be someone who matters to me." So that's pretty awesome. I thought this was very similar to Ray Bradbury's list, which, if you go back, season 1, episode 9, Writing with Gusto. And in this, Ray Bradbury talks about how he would just free associate a whole bunch of nouns. And then he looked at each of those nouns, and then he took the nouns and he started writing until he found out what that noun meant to him. Mm-hmm. and he got his stories from that. I think they're both coming from the same place.
Yeah, these process books are really like digging into that like subconscious, writing out the subconscious to get to the good stuff.
So she picks the, I'm going to just start free writing and have something come out. Ray Bradbury basically gave himself a weird prompt. He wrote about it until something came out that was personable to him.
Do you think authors have spent more time just free writing than actually like writing a novel?
That is a good question. I should ask that in one of the interview questions.
Yeah. I mean, like the amount of hours spent just barfing on paper.
Number of trees taken down by the literary community. Trees.
To kind of wrap this up, she kind of says, there's no way to tell until you've got it all down. And then there might be just one sentence or one character or one theme that you end up using. But you get it all down, you just write.
Yeah, and so her next chapter then is called Polaroids. For our listeners that are either under the age of 30 or are not hipsters that have rediscovered this technology, what is a Polaroid, Renee?
So Polaroid was this fun device. You took a picture and it printed the picture right in front of you. But the cool thing was it didn't come out right away. It had to develop. You know, it had that iconic look with the big white strip on the bottom and then the tiny white border around the picture. And then you would do this thing where you would like flip it back and forth to get the air into it. I actually don't know the science. And then it would slowly appear so you could watch yourself or the picture just slowly come alive right in front of you. It was like magic.
And like often the light stuff would come up first and the dark stuff. And so she uses this metaphor to describe how she takes that thing that's meaningful, that single sentence about the boy, and then brings out all the other stuff. So the first chapter was about just mining your subconscious. And this next part is where you actually have what you want, but how do you get deep into it?
And she says, writing a first draft is very much like watching a Polaroid develop. You can't. And in fact, you're not supposed to know exactly what the picture is going to look like. And I wonder why we're not supposed to. And I'm always catching myself like, you know, Bradbury says, don't think. Like I catch myself trying to predict and think where things are going. And I have to constantly rein myself back because I know it's a trap. Like I know that's wrong, but I don't really know why.
First of all, I don't think it's possible to not know where something's going on some level. Obviously, it can't all be just discovery writing the whole way through. But maybe this is a bit of that transition between discovery writing and knowing where it's going. I've read about the idea of flow, where you're writing and things just come to you and you've got this character doing something and the words that they say just come out, or the action that they take, or this thing that they use then to solve the problem. It's just, it's there in your mind. And I think what she's talking about here is that state where you are watching stuff and it's just the answers are coming to you. Like just the right perfect insight or sentence or event comes into your writing and you just write it down. Because that's the idea of a Polaroid. It's like, you know, it's there. You just don't see it and then over time it comes up. I think that's the idea she's getting at here.
Right.
Everybody wants to get into flow and this is kind of her mental framework for getting into flow.
I like that. I actually hadn't thought about that. But yeah, it makes sense. And this is a way to trust that you're outsourcing the motivation or you're outsourcing putting things on paper where you're not thinking, I'm writing a book. You're thinking, no, I'm just writing about school lunches. And then from there, I pull a character. And now I'm just slowly building and trusting that this character will come alive and that they'll have a family and that a plot will ensue.
Yeah. The example she uses here is from an article she wrote about a Special Olympics day that she witnessed. And she brings up the fact that she didn't know exactly what she was going to write about. She didn't go saying, oh, I'm going to talk about the uplifting quality of watching these athletes participate. And, you know, she wasn't actively going, I'm going to find the family I'm going to use. I'm going to find the athlete. I'm going to do all this stuff. She went there. She just experienced it. And things slowly build. And what she says in the end, she knew exactly who she was going to use to tell the story about. And she knew what it was about them that was really going to tell the story. And she felt it. Mm-hmm. And you could just tell at the end of this that she was excited to write this piece and she knew what it was going to be about. I did have this experience in a very similar setup. I was doing field reporting and I got to do a story on great white sharks. And
I was out on the boat with this firefighter that enjoyed taking his boat out and looking at sharks.
Okay.
And I had my little recorder on that was recording everything. And then, like, the shark rises up and you see it. And these guys are big. And Renee, that's this terrifying. Isn't very far from shore in Santa Cruz.
In yeah. Santa Cruz?
Oh, yeah. We were just out by some of, like, the West Beaches. But they were out there. Like, we were on the boat and I could see the shoreline and everybody walking on the shore. No. We weren't that far away.
Oh, my God.
And these guys are, like, 8 or 9 feet long. And they just would come up to the boat. You wear sunglasses to cut through the water to see better. And you just see them come in. And sometimes they came very close to the boat. And it was awesome. And then at a certain point, one of the whale watching tours comes by. And I hear someone say, hey, it's Shark Week, guys. And, you know, it was just all there. And that story, when I sat down to write it, was the easiest feature I've ever written. It just flowed out. So, yeah, I think this does actually happen. If you can get into what you're writing enough that you just feel it, you can have that magic.
I've had a few moments, I've written a few poems where I sat down and it came out. It just happened. I almost like, where did that time go? And it just happened and it was great and it got published. I sometimes wonder about it and I think, you know, there were so many poems I worked endlessly on and all of that work is probably what really went into that poem. It wasn't that I sat down and I could repeat that process now that I've done it because I couldn't. It was all the work I'd done before that was unseen that when I sat down that day, everything just kind of like got into my brain. Some of the best poems I've ever written were written very quickly. I mean, I edited them later, but it was just...
But the creation process wasn't painful, and it wasn't slow and plodding, and it wasn't full of self-doubt, because you just knew this was right. And so I think this chapter is a bit more of a promise to people.
I would be afraid to say that word, because, you know, some days you sit down and it comes out, and some days you don't. Mm-hmm. And the stuff that comes out all of a sudden isn't always good. You think it is, but sometimes it's not. You can't know. And you can't try to chase it.
Except I knew that one time, that one article.
But you had that one. But what happened since then? You've written lots of good stuff. But it didn't just...
No.
You can chase that.
Mm-hmm. This article is a promise. This is like, just so you know, this possible thing could happen to you if you dedicate yourself to writing.
And like once or twice. But not every time. Trying to say that it's going to happen every time?
I don't know, but she ends with, you would have loved it. I tell my students, you would have felt like you could write all day. I think she is saying to her students that, yeah, this thing could happen to you.
But just don't expect it to happen all the time. You know, I've got Polaroids that just disintegrated.
Or Polaroids were in the dark and never got light.
Yeah.
The exposure sucked.
Right. And you know what? That's most of the time. Not the Polaroids. They were normally really good. No, the writing. It comes out like that, but there's those times and it just comes together. I just feel like I overly chase those feelings and I know it's wrong. But I'm like, oh, but I wish it would just happen that way and it doesn't. Anyway, we're on the third chapter, character.
Right, so this is now a ship. The first couple of chapters were all about like, you know, how to get the words out, how to mine for things. And now it's like, okay, let's talk about some specifics. And this is a specific thing, character, and what makes for a good character.
So she had a friend who said this, and it was really cool because I was like, oh, I said something similar once in an article. She said, every single one of us at birth is given an emotional acre all our own. Right? You really get to do with your acre as you please. And I once wrote an article about time management, about every day is like a landscape. And what you plant in that landscape, what you do in that landscape, how you walk across that landscape, you get to decide. So I don't know. I thought that was kind of cool. I was like, oh, an emotional acre.
So then she goes on to say that every character in your story also gets an emotional acre that they tend. I think she means to say is every character has their own interior life, and it's a rich interior life. And just as our own interior life affects how we interact with the world and our responses and everything that the world sees of us comes from this interior life, this emotional acre, that your characters need to have the same thing.
Right. Like, you could extend this metaphor, dear listener, that you're driving down the car and you're listening to us, right? Put your head in the space of, okay, imagine you have an emotional acre that you've had since birth. Is it planted with flowers? With crops? Is it like a desert? You know, like, what have you done with your emotional acre in reaction to the life that you have had? If bad things have happened to you, did you still plant your acre with flowers? Some people do. Or did you not plant it at all? Are you constantly tilling it, looking for things? Or trying to fix that soil, but nothing ever grows? Right? Like, that's, I think that's what she's getting at, right?
Right. So that's all a big metaphor for what, you know, goes on in a person's head and how their personality, everything responses. But this is a pretty big sell. I mean, there are lots of characters in a person's book. Renee, I know that you've got this fiction story in your head that you are still kind of poking at and all that. Do you have characters for that story yet?
I have a few.
Do they each have an emotional acre?
Yes.
And how did that happen?
I was using a different strategy for myself that I read about using contradictory traits in a person. Like, they're a good person, but they still underfeed their cat on purpose. Right? Like, how can someone be a good person, but also never want to speak to their adopted daughter?
So you gave your characters these contradictory traits. So you basically went down and say, okay, this is character A, and they're going to be friendly. And then you come up with an instance where they're not friendly.
Well, it's not that they're not friendly. It's that people are complicated. Not complicated to understand, but like, you know, I would like to say I'm a good person, but I've probably done stuff that hasn't been so good, but that makes me a dynamic person. You want to imbue your characters with something similar, because if someone's completely all likable or all hateable, we just don't like them because they're not very real.
So my question, though, is how did you come up with these contradictory traits? Were they kind of floating in your head and you just needed an example to express them? Or did you actually go to the character and say, okay, they're friendly, but I'm going to pull a contradictory trait?
Yeah, I mean, I pull from my life. I look at the people around me and I'm like, I think of a person and go, huh, this one person is like this. And then maybe I'll mix it. Like, what would this person be like if I gave them this thing my aunt did? Mm-hmm. And then you're like, whoa, that is a weird, real person. Like, for example, and I've mentioned this before, one of my favorite short stories slash movies was Sideways. It's that wine movie. Dear listener, and
that whiny wine movie.
Yes. And part of the reason I love it is because it goes through California landscape where I grew up. But what I really loved about that story, the characters were complicated. They were on the surface despicable, but there was more to them. They had a redemptive arc. Is that a word, redemptive? Mm-hmm. And it was so good. Like, there's this guy and you feel bad for him because you want him to find love and get out of the rut in his life. But then he goes into his mother's drawer and steals money. He goes to visit his mother to steal cash so he can buy wine for his friend. You're like, what the hell? You know?
So that's really a contradictory trait there, isn't it?
It is. It's like, how can you like a person that does that? That's what I find wonderful about a story is you can do that, but it takes, like, you need to be clever about it. Anyway, that's what I thought of when I was reading this. I'm like, yeah, I think a character that has had a horrible life and people were horrible to them and they still planted their acre with flowers, or people who've had nothing but awesome things happen to them and their acre is a desert. I want to read that story.
So that kind of goes to the next thing she was talking about. Like, I wrote down all the things that she suggested that you should do for characters, and some felt a little bit contradictory. But
did you bullet point Anne Lamott?
Yeah.
Wasn't easy. You bickamized Miss Lamott.
It's note-taking. You don't have any notes for this. I'm really impressed. Like, before, you had, like, pages on your computer.
I had to write snark notes. I was writing really, really detailed chapter notes. And so I did it like a grad student. And now that I'm just investing in the show notes, I don't have to do that as much.
I see. Well, anyway, I still have notes. But she talks about how your characters are aspects of you, the good parts and the bad parts. Are your characters aspects of you, Renee?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Like she said in a few chapters ago, if you put your neuroses on the page, if you give your character your neuroses, you know it better than anybody else. You can make it very real.
It's like this special resource you have. It's like you've been doing a case study on this individual their entire life, and you can access all this stuff for your character.
You have a PhD in you.
Now, the next thing she says is that you need to let bad things happen to your characters.
Right.
And if you take these two parts together, you basically have to have a part of yourself on the page and you let something bad happen to them. And I think one of the neat strengths about approaching this is that you can find something bad that would really hurt you personally. Because often the bad things that happen, like you have your character's parents die, it is a bad thing. And yet it's also a very, very generic bad things happen. And I've seen it happen to so many characters for so long. It's like the Disney story. Of course the kid's an orphan. You have to be an orphan to start off.
And the mother dies.
Well, you know the reason for that, right? The mother's the person that's looking after the kid. So,
oh, you're... God.
Oh. You can count on the father to be irresponsible and let the kid get away with whatever. Oh. But, you know, if mom's around, she's going to keep that kid safe. So you got to get rid of her.
Oh, God. Wow, that just kind of... Wow. I just assumed the mother would be the one.
I think one thing I find when I'm maybe in a critique group or whatever and someone has a story and they have the bad thing that happens is I've seen that bad thing happen so much that it doesn't actually touch me. It doesn't resonate with me when I'm reading the story. It's like, oh, yes, of course you killed off this person. Yes, you know, of course they had this bad thing happen. Part of it's also that often these bad things, like the dead mother, are jumping off parts for the story. It's like you have to have something bad happen in order to push the story forward. So it's almost like a requirement. And if something's a requirement, it just doesn't hit me as hard.
That would be a trope, right? If you're using a trope to make a bad thing happen to a character because only trouble is interesting, right? Then if you pick something very obvious, we've been inundated with the dead mother in Disney. Like, or another one, using rape as a plot device. Like, it's old. Please stop doing it. You got to be more clever and you got to think of something else.
But for a beginner writer, the problem is that they hear that, okay, I can't use that. And then there'll be some book that makes the bestseller list that uses that, or some book that uses it really, really well. And it's integral to the book and integral to the story. So the question is, why does that accomplished writer, it's not a get away with it. I think the issue is that you need to remember that your character has an emotional acre. And these bad things that you do to them have an effect on that emotional acre. And if you just attach the bad things with plot, but not with the character itself, it's not going to feel real.
I don't remember who said it, but I've heard some talks about plot and character. And somebody had said something like, what happens in the book is actually not that important. What's more important is how the character reacts to it and their emotional landscape. Especially with memoir, it's like people think it's what happened to them that was interesting. And yes, that's going to be a part of it. But what's most important is how it affected you. And that's supposedly what people are reading or why they're picking up your book. What do you think, Kim?
Yeah, that's what makes something a story as opposed to just a series of events. I was thinking back to some of our other books. The Bickham, good old Bickham, starts off his book with the beginnings of... You start off with something that threatens a self-concept of the main character. That's how he says you begin the books. We discussed that in our season 1, episode 17, starting your book off right. And this is the same thing. You're affecting that emotional acre. And that's what starts the story.
Yeah. So I really like that she asks her friends. What Kim was just saying, she's got a really good quote in here from her friend that said, "The evidence is in and you are the verdict." And then she says, this will be true for each of your characters. Like, things have happened. The evidence is in. You can't change the things that have happened. But what's the verdict?
Right.
That's the story.
So there's another one that she brings in. She also says that it is important to have a likable narrator. And you covered a little bit this with your idea of your sideways thing. But is it required to have a likable narrator?
Well, so here's the thing. The main character is not necessarily the narrator, right? Or is she saying first-person point of view?
Let's see here. She says, so she asked a friend of hers, what was the most valuable thing he knew about writing? And without hesitation, he said, nothing is as important as a likable narrator. Nothing holds a story together better. So, a likable narrator.
Likable narrator. He didn't say a likable main character.
Right. But I mean, unless you're going to something like Bronte or whatever, the narrator is often the main character.
So we'll just
right?
use narrator slash main character. We're talking about the same
thing. Yeah, the person whose head you live in when you're reading the story.
Okay.
So she says, having a likable narrator is like having a great friend whose company you love, whose mind you love to pick, whose running commentary totally holds your attention, who makes you laugh out loud, whose lines you always want to steal. And I want to add, it's also a lot more fun to write a character like this.
I would agree.
But on the other hand, I mean, there's a whole bunch of grim, dark narrators and stuff. Where do you fall on this?
Well, I'll bring up another nice quote from Lamott about this. She says, a person's faults are largely what make him or her likable. And if we need to connect with our protagonists emotionally for us to care about their journey, think about the faults. That's what I think is dragging me into the story, like with Sideways. That guy is full of faults, but they're practically hilarious. I mean, there's a scene where he's going down the hill drinking the spit wine. Like, oh my God, what a pathetic guy. But yet I still really like that character.
You know, the beautiful thing about characters in books is that you can put them down and walk away. It's not something you can do with family members.
No.
But sometimes people will just put down a book and not pick it up because they don't like the narrator.
Oh, that's true. Yeah. I've had, actually just recently, I've abandoned two books because I'm like, nah, I'm good.
So what was it about the narrators that you didn't like?
I think maybe it was just the writing. But also the narrator was just like a cardboard box. They just really had no personality at all. And I'm like, eh, okay.
So they weren't a person you'd want to spend time with.
No, I don't want to spend time with that person. They weren't real. They seemed like a cardboard box. It was just like, I don't want to spend time with a cardboard box. Mm-hmm. I want to spend time with someone a little bit more dynamic, a little bit more interesting. And again, like they say, only trouble is interesting. But there is a tipping point where they become so messed up that they're not going to be likable anymore. And the thing with Sideways, what I thought was so artful was that it really, that balance, he was teetering back and forth on likable, not likable. And it kept it going.
The other thing too, is sometimes you just want to read to find out what the heck would happen to a person like this. The thing about likable is, I mean, sometimes it means entertaining or you want to spend time with them, but sometimes it's likable enough in that you're interested in them. And if you're given somebody that has these particular flaws and has these propensities to do these things, you just want to watch and see what happens to a person like that. How are they affected?
Well, I'm actually curious, Kim, has there been a book that you were reading that you were like, I don't like this narrator, and then you put it down because they weren't likable enough?
I actually read a book all the way through that I didn't like the narrator of.
Was it assigned? Is that why you had to
finish it? No. I was in a period of my time where I was like determined to read books all the way through to see what they were, if they were worth anything or not. And this book was intentionally written to have a narrator that was unreliable, which is a whole different thing, but he was just very self-centered. He was good-looking and wealthy enough and witty enough that all things in his life were going just fine until he was attacked and he had brain damage, so he couldn't put the words together very well. No, this is by Atara French.
Okay.
So the interesting thing about this book was that he comes off as a likable character at the beginning because, you know, everything's good for him and there's this and that. And, you know, yeah, he's a little bit, you know, like the Sideways characters. Like, there's some qualities that aren't that great, but, you know, he's likable. He's got a girlfriend that loves him a lot, that kind of thing. And it's all kind of cool. And then he gets this brain damage. But the thing is that he still sees everything. But the thing I found that was issue with that book was that at times it was kind of hard for me to realize that his presentation to everybody had changed. Then, like, more things come up, and eventually he's framed for a murder he didn't commit. But she wanted to tell a story about this kind of individual who wasn't likable, and you didn't quite realize he was likable until further and further in. And then you really kind of started to see the real him, and it just, you know, I kept reading it, but I liked him less and less and less. And in that kind of toxic friendship kind of way, it's like, you just kind of want to let him go.
Yeah, if you make a narrator that's like a toxic friend, I'm going to put that book down. I've had too many of those in my life.
I mean, it was an interesting concept the writer had, and I can see kind of why she wanted to explore it. But I would say that was a book that if I hadn't been determined to finish it, I would have put it down. It was like you wanted to wash your hands after it.
Well, so I had a similar experience I think a lot of people have had with Lolita. It is written so well. Oh my God. That's what gets you, is the writing is done so well. and the voice is so strong in it. And I couldn't get past chapter 4. It's just that's when it started getting into this stuff. And I'm like, no, I can't. And I didn't want to get into that guy's brain. Like, some people have done things that are so bad, they can't be likable enough at that point. And I just didn't want it in my head, I guess. So I had to stop reading. I wanted to desperately keep reading.
Because you were enjoying the actual...
the voice and the writing. Oh, my God. And it was just so good. And I was like, but I was like, this is going to be in my head. And I won't ever be able to get it out of my head.
It is an incredibly dark story. Like, when you get to the end of that book and he gives you the punch at the end, I guess we are covering unreliable narrators. We were thinking about, since there's so much stuff here on character, that we would possibly move it over to the bonus podcast, because this is really interesting stuff and there's some other ideas too. So I think we'll table the unreliable narrator and just go to the thing I noticed at the end of this chapter on characters. And she says, just don't pretend you know more about your characters than they do, because you don't. Stay open, listen to them. It's tea time and all the dolls are at the table. Listen, it's that simple. And this chapter isn't that simple. This chapter is packed with stuff. And I would just like to say that this is a chapter probably that you could read 3 or 4 times through and pick up different stuff every time.
This is the type of chapter you want a bullet point. There's even a detail in here where she's like, oh, you want to like really get to know your characters and figure out what's in their pockets and all this other stuff. Honestly, I was like, oh, that's a character questionnaire. You can download a really good one at the Gotham website. And I give it to my students. It's like this exhaustive questionnaire on who is your character. And it asks the weirdest stuff. Well, what's his political party? And, you know, what does your character like to eat for breakfast? You're like, what? But all of those details, they make a person, not just a cardboard cutout of a person.
Yeah. So, like I said, I think this is actually one of those chapters where reading it and reading it carefully and just reading a paragraph and considering it would go a long way to understanding what she has to say about character. So here's the plan. We are going to do a bonus podcast releasing next week on our Patreon site. And you want to tell them about the Patreon site?
So you head over to Patreon and go to the Abby the Fabulous tier, and you can listen to our conversation, continuing our conversation on the unreliable narrator.
And I'm going to say the other thing that we're doing, if you want to have some interesting conversations, this might actually be the topic, I don't know, for our next week's process group. Actually, if you go to our website, there is a link to go to Meetup and to sign up for our process group, where we have had some pretty good conversations about writing processes and ways to get over stumbling blocks.
Yeah, last night was great. We had somebody writing textbooks. We had somebody writing a handbook. We had somebody writing a young adult novel. We had somebody writing
screenplays.
I mean, just, it was cool. And but I loved how even the guy writing the textbook, we all had like advice for them, but also it was applicable to us in some ways too. I thought that was really neat.
It was a good time. So that's another thing to check out. And also, if you are enjoying this podcast, we would love it if you would write us an Apple review. That would just be really special. So
we'll read it on the air. If it's nice.
If it's nice.
If it's nice.
Okay. Anyway. Until next time.
Until bis morgen. Bis später.
Tschüss.
Tschüss.
Words to Write By is produced by Renee Nelson and Kim Smith-Adam. Our theme music is Roll Back the Carpet by Cool Cat Music. Have a great day.
Maybe I need to get a less squeaky chair.